Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG for short, a housing group for older people run by older people. Present
Raise the Roof!
We advocate for secure, affordable and appropriate housing. So listen up on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30pm on 3CR 855 on your AM dial.
That's right, you're listening to Raise the Roof, the Housing for the Aged Action Group show here on 3CR, 8:55am. My name's Shane, I'm here with Fiona. She's just having a little giggle behind the microphone. How are you doing today, Fiona?
I'm good, Shane. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's happening today?
So on today's show, we have something a little bit different for you. We have an interview that was done by a member of the Save Public Housing Collective, Danielle, in February. And this interview is with Dr. Rachel Yampolsky, who's an urban geographer. And she has been looking into the heritage listing of some of the 44 public housing estates, which are the towers, including most recently in North Melbourne. And she goes into a little bit of detail about the process of heritage listing and why she thinks they need to be heritage listed as kind of places of significance for people. Then we'll have a little break and we'll go into more of a discussion with Dr. Rachel on the history of the 55 towers, which I think would be of interest to many of our listeners.
Oh, that does sound very interesting. I can't wait.
The heritage of the 55 plus towers in Melbourne. So we'll go straight into that interview now.
I'm with Dr. Yampolsky, an urban geographer who has pursued a heritage listing of some of the 44 public housing estates, including most recently North Melbourne, and I'm here to listen to the account of this process. Rachel has also been a long-term contributing member of the Save Public Housing Collective. Rachel, tell us about the heritage submission process you've been through to try to get some of the 44 public housing towers heritage listed.
So I've been working with a number of different community groups to find avenues to get some of the estates that are obviously due for demolition heritage listed. So for context, for those that are not maybe super familiar with our heritage system, in Australia we have three tiers of heritage. We have local heritage, which is administered by the relevant local council, and that acknowledges places with distinct local significance. Then we've got the state heritage register, which is probably the main mechanism for heritage, and this is a register that lists buildings, places, as well as items that are considered of significance to the state of Victoria, which is a really arbitrary and complex concept sometimes to argue what Victorian identity or heritage means. And then there's, of course, the National Heritage Register, which lists things like technically Uluru's on it, Sydney Harbour Bridge, things that speak to a national identity. But that one is, there's really less than 200 places on the National Heritage Register. It's really reserved for, extra special places. So the main mechanism for real substantial preservation with teeth, is in fact the State Heritage Register. And so that's what we've been working on, trying to get some of these states nominated to the Victorian Heritage Register. And so effectively how that would work, if something was deemed to be of significance and put onto the register, it's automatically granted a certain level of protection depending on what is identified as significant. So the assessment process would identify what's significant, essentially encode that into a planning overlay, and then would stipulate a set of protections that have to specifically address what is considered significant. So if the material is considered significant, the protections will focus on the material. If the name is considered significant, the protections will focus on the name, and so on.
Yeah. So what would material be an example of?
Oh, so literally often the facade, and this is how you see a lot of examples of what in the heritage world is called facadism, where the facade of an old building has been kept and everything past the immediate first 5 centimetres is gutted and reworked. So there really is a bias in our heritage protection towards the facades, and that's why you see a lot of buildings can get gutted internally. However, in the case of the public housing towers, that's actually not necessarily a problem, because we obviously want to see the towers retrofit and upgraded. And so there's this sort of common anxiety, and a very reasonable anxiety, that a heritage protection would lock the towers in place and in time and not allow for even basic, let alone substantial upgrades and retrofits. However, if the submission acknowledges that the significance of them is the towers as public housing towers, and that is what's significant as opposed to the brick and mortar, it creates a lot of leeway for retrofit. And I'll also note that even the most intense heritage listing in terms of preservation, like they stipulate an extremely wide list of criteria for what must be preserved, even in those cases there is always a provision that amenity and updates that ensure livability and sustainability and safety are automatically exempt from permits. So if you need to upgrade your cooling system, if you need to upgrade accessibility, you never need a real permit for that.
So the government's excuse says sometimes one of the excuses, I think, has been upgrading things in terms of disability access. So that would be exempt anyway.
Totally, yes.
So what did the process look like to apply for this? And the other thing is, you said you're trying to get an exemption for the whole public housing as like a kind of place. So like what sort of criteria does that, what does that mean?
Totally. So heritage is this frustrating thing where the heritage assessment process, how it works, and maybe that's a useful context for to give you context for where we are in the campaign. It essentially takes three kind of key steps. The first one is a public nomination. So the state itself can never put a place up for protection. Only the public can. And there's this common misconception I find when I talk to people about it, that they assume the state can self-nominate, it can self-identify what it thinks is important and put it up for preservation. That doesn't actually work like that. Wow. It requires the public to put something up and to be proactive, and that's the only way that an assessment process is triggered and can only be triggered by the public. And so I think a lot of people just have this feeling that, oh, well, someone else is triggering it, someone else is taking care of it. And in the case of the towers, most people I talked to thought, oh, I already thought it was heritage listed, you know, or at least there'd been attempts made. And that's obviously not the case. So it starts with anyone from the general public. You don't have to live there. You don't have to have any material or social ties to the place, putting in a request for a nomination assessment. And then the first body who does an assessment, who receives that submission and does the first round of assessment, is called Heritage Victoria. And they're a bureaucratic arm in the government. They sit, I believe, in the planning department. And so they, you know, have their internal experts and they do an assessment. And at the end of that assessment process, which can take anywhere from 5 weeks to 2-3 years, the executive director of Heritage Victoria will make a formal recommendation, and they will either recommend to list the place or not list the place, or they can also recommend to list parts of the place and not other parts. So they might say, well, we did an assessment and we only found one part of this estate is significant, for example. And then what happens is it then gets handed over to the Heritage Council, which is an independent expert statutory body who makes the final decision. And so they receive the report and the recommendation for the executive director, as well as any public submissions that come in during that time.
So they're independent, but who funds them?
So they're government appointed and they are government funded. Right. So they're an independent statutory body. So they're still very much, in the government, but they're not in the bureaucratic tier of the government. Yeah. But they are appointed, and I think they're appointed on a 2-year rolling basis from memory.
So kind of like courts of law.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so when it goes to the council, there's a period of public submissions, usually 60 days. Anyone can put in submissions. Stakeholders can put in submissions. You can also request a hearing. The Heritage Council then runs a hearing where they hear submissions either for or against, and then they make the final ruling. And so that's usually the process. The it's this frustrating thing where on the surface, this process seems and is designed to seem really accessible, that anyone in the general public can put in a submission. Mm-hmm. And that is technically true. That's administratively true. Like anyone can create an account on the planning portal and put in a submission. It's free. You don't have to prove any kind of, you know, credentials to be able to do it, anything of the like. You just have to have an email address, really. But the challenge becomes that a lot of submissions that get put in get rejected because they don't speak to the heritage criteria. And so this is where it gets a bit tricky. So for something to get onto the Victorian Heritage Register, it has to meet at least one of seven heritage criteria. And the criteria are, I would argue, really not intuitive to what you and I would consider to be of actual heritage significance. So like a lot of people talk to me about the building when I mention I'm working on this, and they have all these incredible stories. And the frustrating thing is those stories don't translate to this really specific and highly technical set of criteria and threshold criteria that you then have to argue that a place satisfies in order to get listed. And so while it's technically a completely accessible process and it's open to anyone in the public, to really actually be successful in your nomination, you have to know how to create really technical arguments that can address a very specific and very counterintuitive set of criteria. Yeah, right. And so it becomes quite difficult, unfortunately. It's not impossible, but it is not as accessible as it probably looks on, you know, on first glance. Yeah, so look, there's a set of criteria. One of the latest criteria that got added after a lot of push from the industry is criterion G, which is social value. It's when a place has social value. And so for a long time, social value wasn't even captured in our heritage criteria. And this is why there has been such a privileging of like architecture and design and materiality when it comes to preserving a place, and not so much for like the lived stories. And so there was a big push to have that better reflected, and they extended the criteria for the first time in decades, and they added a seventh criteria, social value criteria G, which it was, you know, a huge moment and a milestone. However, it's really rarely tested. Like very rarely a place is actually accepted onto the Heritage Register because they've satisfied that criteria. So it's this funny one where they've added it, but they don't really engage with it because it's, you know, probably quite hard to prove, but also could really open a can of worms politically.
So is there any precedence of winning on this social value?
Not from my memory, no.
Okay. Yeah. So that's quite exciting, yeah. But it's like a test for us.
Totally.
So where are you at now? What's happened with, I understand you put in, I thought, an application for Flemington and North Melbourne, and then it's only been North Melbourne. Can you tell us what happened with those two estates?
So I've been working on a couple of nominations of different estates, and we started with just trying to identify the ones that had the best chance of meeting the threshold criteria, because the challenge with the towers is inherent in the heritage assessment process of any estate is a requirement to do comparative analysis. You have to always compare between, you know, similar examples. So classic ones, people want to list their Carlton North Terrace. It's probably already listed, but let's just use that as an example. Well, they have seven neighbours of that have identical terraces.
Yeah.
So how can you prove this terrace is significant, right? So there's this inherent component in a heritage assessment process that you have to prove why something that you're nominating is the exemplar in that class type. And so this becomes freaking hard with the towers when you've got 44 near identical looking towers that are built in a really similar system, built during a similar period, built under a similar epoch and policy strategy. And so it's like, how do you prove one estate is more significant than the other?
So what I'm hearing is, but you need one precedence to prove that the next one meets a similar criteria, not necessarily that one is better than the other. Like, so if they've rejected one, like say they've rejected Flemington Estate,
yeah,
and there's 44 towers, then they have precedence that they should all be rejected.
Totally.
But we're trying to do the opposite.
Yes.
So
that was Dr. Rachel Iampolsky, an urban geographer, being interviewed by Danielle from the Save Public Housing Collective.
I thought that was pretty interesting. I mean, my understanding is that the modern Australian heritage listing system basically comes from when squatters occupied the Victoria Street built, you know, properties in Sydney in King's Cross in the 70s that Abe Saffron was trying to sort of strong-arm his way into demolishing and replacing. So you know, there's some heroic resistance happening in public housing towers that are threatened at the moment. And it's interesting to see the idea of heritage listing being a way to resist as well.
Yeah, I think those houses were terrace houses, and Dr. Rachel did mention terrace houses in that interview, but this is a bit different because this is towers. So yeah, see how we go with that one. We might just go to some community service announcements. You are listening to 3CR Raise the Roof.
8:55 a.m.
That's the one. And we'll be right back.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
City Limits.
Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9 a.m.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
We're now going to hear the second part of the interview that Danielle did with Dr. Rachel, specifically about the history of the 55 plus towers in Melbourne. So by that, we're talking about the older person's housing, which has been designated for just people over 55 to live in. And if you listened to previous shows, you would hear about our concerns with the impending demolition of those buildings. And so, yeah, it talks a little bit about the history of how they came about as part of slum reclamation. So, and big thanks to Danielle for doing this in these interviews and for sharing them with our Raise the Roof show.
Mm-hmm. All right, and just one more question. Please, if you could tell us about the historical significance of the overall program that built the 44 towers.
So the towers are a product of a period of Victoria's policy history that I would argue is really unprecedented, right? And so they were built by the Housing Commission of Victoria, which no longer exists. But at the time, they were like one of the most prolific builders in Victoria's history. And so it was a product of the slum reclamation program. And so there was this sort of reformist era activists who were sort of arguing that the inner city living conditions for the poor were not working, and they pushed for these slum reclamation programs, and the Housing Commission of Victoria quickly came in, and they, you know, were initially building low rise and low density housing. But at the time in Europe, happening in parallel was,
did you say what year that was? Or approximate year 50s, period?
Late 50s. And then in the sort of early 60s, you know, the Housing Commission was really trying to find ways to economise money and land. And they were looking at what was happening in Europe, and they were building so much of these big estates. And they sent a bunch of their architects, the Housing Commission of Victoria's architects, over to Europe on study tours. And they went, did a bunch of study tours, came back, and were like, no, we need to build high, we need to build density, we need to build with concrete. And they moved to the model that led to the towers we have today. And the towers are also really unique in that they are prefabricated concrete structures. And so they were and this was the first time the government had experimented with prefabricated building and construction. And they built them at a factory in Holmes Glen that the government ended up purchasing and turning exclusively into prefabricating for the Housing Commission's program. And actually the factory still stands, I believe it's heritage listed actually, but to fact check me on that one. So they built them, they were prefabricated and then came to site, built them like a house of cards. And they built these tremendous towers, and they built like they've never built before. I mean, the amount that got built particularly in the 60s, in that 10 years when the Housing Commission was really, really active across the inner city was, you know, truly unprecedented. They've never built that much before, and they've never built that much since. And it really signaled a significant moment in Victoria's housing and social policy history, in that they really thought we need to build high and we need to prevent urban sprawl. That was the strategy at the time.
Just on that, because it sounds like historically it's relevant for the government to be proud of what occurred.
Totally.
And historically it's something as a state we should be proud of what we did, but it's like erasure of...
Totally.
So it's kind of gross. But also another question is, each state, like obviously around Fitzroy it was slums, and...
Yep.
What were the other ones like, Carlton and
North Melbourne,
Flemington? Was it these slum areas as well, or they're different kind of social heritage stuff?
Yeah, North Melbourne was actually the largest slum declaration area. And listen, you know, history has... The telling of the history of the slum reclamation program has taken some turns. It was originally seen as this really great thing the government did, and, you know, there's increasingly recognition that some of it was probably just a land grab and not all of it was truly slum. And, you know, and so maybe, and ironically, there is a bit of history repeating itself with the government's agenda to demolish today. But
sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. No.
Oh, sorry. Hold on. Previously, the government was land grabbing for themselves for government ownership, and now they seem to be land grabbing on behalf of corporations and property developers.
Yes, well, you're right. That is a major distinction. So I shouldn't compare them just like that. But no, that's true. But look, wherever you stand on the slum reclamation element, because that is a contentious history at best, you can't deny just how much they built. And it really was at the time not just considered for quote-unquote the urban poor. Like, it was also accessible to what was considered middle class at the time. And it was, particularly North Melbourne, was designed with families, and there was this big push to develop for lone older persons, was the technical language at the time. And even at the time, the biggest and fastest growing demographic of people needing social public housing was older single women, which is still the trend today. That hasn't changed, you know, particularly post-war. They were, you know, suddenly widowed and needing support, and so they built these programs specifically for lone older persons, particularly women, and for migrants. We had a huge migration boom at the time, and this was built to house that. And so, you know, really, like, to go to your point, like, I think as a Victorian, we should be so proud of that history and then simultaneously so ashamed of the present and the erasure of that history.
Yeah, and also I guess the other thing that we should be really ashamed of now is that things haven't changed enough. In fact, they've got worse for, you know, single women and older lone people, people with disabilities, all the people who should be on the housing list. And at that time, they were like literally expanding this opportunity to the middle class. So it was actually really progressive as a government. And now, look, we're going backwards, aren't we?
I agree. And look, and they were also building, they were experimenting at the time also with suburban, like single dwelling builds. And that was designed to be like carry less stigma at the time. Mm-hmm. And then when they moved to high density, right? And at the time that the commission, just before the commission dissolved, the housing commission, it was really only doing high density towards the end. And there was still a little bit of stigma around this, around high density and inner city. Whereas, you know, the, I guess a bit more of the attitude was the middle class people that were being put into public housing were more moving out into the suburbs, and the inner city was saved more for, you know, recent migrants and whatever. But there was a real push to change that attitude and to make the buildings really modern, and to and particularly through the landscaping and the communal areas, they were really designed to create more of like a vertical community and make these sort of like not resort but, you know, really appealing places to live that have, you know, all the amenity in one spot. And I think it was working towards the end. Like, there was a real attitude shift just before the commission disbanded.
Well, sounds like it's worked that a range of different people on different incomes want to live in the inner city now. Yeah. So technically it's worked.
Yes. I guess one of the most successful gentrification bits.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I guess the only other thing that comes up for me is that's at least 40 years, the 1950s, before superannuation was compulsory.
Mm.
So that's it would have been a necessity to have the elderly and single parents, mothers mostly, in make sure they had a roof over their head that wasn't a shanty.
Totally. Yeah. And that, I think that's why it's like doubly insulting that there's this distinct attack right now on older person units. Mm. When, you know, I think Victoria was the first state to have a dedicated program just for older persons, let alone one of that scale. Like that was a really significant program at the time. It was really groundbreaking and to this day, still unprecedented. Like we've still not done it the way we did it then. And so to just do this sort of wholesale attack on all of those estates, or nearly all of them are in tranche three, I think is really disgraceful, because it's sort of like not only for the people living there that are directly affected, but it's also spitting on what is a really significant part of Victoria's history that we should be proud of. Like we should have that recognized.
Yeah. And it should be expanded rather than people who want to have no option but to live in a caravan. All right, thank you so much. And so I'll, if you want to contact Rachel, it's rachelimpolsky@gmail.com, and I'll put that in the show notes.
I just want to give a shout out. We're wrapping up for today, but wanted to say hello to a recent HAG member and listener who I met for the first time at our general meeting the other week. Thanks for your support. Sorry I didn't get to talk to you more, but look forward to seeing you around the place. So see, if you come along to our meetings, you'll get called, shouted out on the radio.
Does this person have a name?
Yeah, well, I don't know if they want their name.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Always see, welcome.
I can even be discreet about this once in a while.
There's a couple of events that we wanted to plug while we had you before we finish up for this show. So there's going to be a Safe Public Housing Collective is putting on a screening of the documentary Bay Views for All, The Fight to Save Barrack Beacon. And it's a free screening down in St Kilda at the St Kilda Sports Club. It's at 6:30 on the 25th of March. A little bit of food and drink, I believe, is provided if you get there a bit earlier. And there's going to be panellists from the Homeless Persons Union. There's going to be one of the former residents there, Jeannie, who's also be speaking, and someone from 44 Flats United as well.
So that's 6 o'clock for a 6:30 start.
That's right, on the 25th of March.
Yeah, it's funny that you pointed that, because I thought HAG hated public housing.
HAG loves public housing. We've always been a big, strong supporter of public housing, and we definitely support people's efforts to retain and build more public housing. So if you want to find out more about what happened down at Barrack Beacon, that's a good place to start. There's also some other documentaries screening. You may recall that one of our care finders featured in a documentary called Careless that won the Audience Award at the Melbourne International Film Festival. The film's called, did I say it was called Careless?
You did.
Oh, good. So it's just come out on Netflix for those of you that want to subscribe to Netflix, but some of you may not want to subscribe to Netflix, and so you can go see it for free. There's a bunch of free screenings all around Australia. There's one in Brisbane on the 18th of March, one in Canberra on the 23rd of March, Hobart on the 26th of March, Sydney on the 30th of March, and Melbourne at Palace Kino in the city on the 31st of March. All of them start at 6:30, and they're put on by an organisation called Club Sandwich, which is really working with people who have looking after their kids as well as looking after their elderly parents. And, the filmmakers will be there for Q&A as well. So get on down to one of those screenings in a city near you and support the, I guess, expose of our broken aged care system. So, Shane, that's about it for this fortnight. Do you want to give out the contact details for HAG?
Well, I'm going to have to since you don't know it.
That's correct.
So if you want to give us a call about some of our campaigning, getting involved with the working groups, that sort of thing, you can give us a call on 96547389. That's 03 96547389. Or if you're an older Victorian and you've got a housing issue you want to talk to someone about, best number to call is free 1300 765 178. That's 1300 765 178. You can also find us on sundry social media. Find our website at oldertenants.org.au. You can hear us right here on the second and fourth Wednesday.
Oh my God.
every month. Shout out also to Fiona's mum, our most loyal listener, who asked where I'd been. Here I am.
He's back. Getting the dates wrong. We're about to go out with a song from someone that I heard play on the weekend, actually, a very well-known old Australian folk singer called Margaret Roadknight, and this song is called Love Tastes Like Strawberries.
Sweet.